Sam Bailey is a sober person who is committed to improving the quality of life and well-being of all trans, non-binary, and intersex people. They work as a care navigator at the Claire Project, a charity in Sussex, UK, dedicated to affirming and supporting TNBI people. Sam is also an auricular acupuncturist focusing on serving people in recovery. I am thrilled to welcome Sam to Sober Sex.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more.
She's perfect in every way. So how are you?
I'm very well, yeah, I'm good, thank you. And you?
I'm excellent. I'm like, it's been a very busy day, but I feel like happy to be talking. So thank you for asking.
Cool. No problem.
And where are you?
So I am in Brighton. I am currently sat in my bedroom because I'm trying to be as far away from any distractions as possible.
Cool. Are distractions an issue? As I'm like, here's the dog, and in the other room is my partner using a drill on a wall.
Yeah, so I have like mad ADHD, so yeah, there might be a few squirrel moments.
Okay, cool. We'll try to mitigate those as much as possible. Awesome. And I know that a lot of your work is based in Sussex. Like, did you grow up there, and like, what are the factors that drew you to work there?
No, I didn't grow up in Sussex. We've only been in Brighton for like 7 years. So like as a kid, my dad was in the military, so we moved around a lot. And then as an adult, I've kind of moved around a lot as well. So Kat and I moved to Thailand not long after we got together. And when we moved back from Thailand, our requirements were we needed to be close to London, but not in London. And we wanted to be by the ocean. And so we looked at a map and went, hey, Brighton looks cute. Let's go there.
Awesome.
And that's how we got here.
And Brighton's like super kind of like a queer paradise, no?
Super
like
I hear, gay.
Yeah. But it's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like, it is its own little sort of like queertopia bubble, which is pretty awesome.
Excellent. So I imagine that like a lot of the work that you do has, you know, people who really need it in the area.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Awesome. And what are your pronouns, and what is your experience of gender today? So start out with like the easy questions. We're like, where do you live? Okay.
So my pronouns are they, them, and my experience of gender is that I don't experience gender. So, I identify as agender, and the concept of sort of masculinity and femininity and this binary is never really sat with me. I don't experience myself as either one of those things, or even to be on a spectrum like within those things. So my experience of gender is that I don't experience gender.
You're the first person I think that's like answered in that way, and it's super interesting because I think obviously we've kind of gotten to a place where like it's a social construct, but it's interesting that you kind of like refer to it as like your personal experience. Like, cause I think a lot of people we've talked to, and I think myself also, are kind of experienced like a spectrum and kind of dance between places. And then like, I really appreciate that's like, you're like, I don't know what they're talking about. Like, I understand it kind of like as an intellectual concept, but like embodied.
Yeah, absolutely. And I get that, you know, for some people, they do experience, you know, like fluidity, or like they're solidly in one camp or the other. But to me, or for me, I just don't, you know, I don't think that any part of myself belongs to gender, if that makes sense. So I don't experience masculinity, I don't experience femininity. And like, it looks great on other folks, and like, good for you, and that's cool. But yeah, I feel like I myself am outside of that.
Amazing. That's really helpful. Thank you.
No worries.
And just FYI, like, your microphone is hitting your collarbone a little bit.
Oh, is it?
So if you could just be like, careful.
You're gonna like hold it out here. Is that
you can hold it, or you can like tuck the wire over your ear, and maybe that'll help.
Is that like gonna That's a good look, right?
That works. It's wild, but it's functional. So thank you. And I'm curious as to like, what were the first messages you remember receiving around sex and sexuality? And if at that moment you were like, but this whole like gender thing, like, was it a conscious thought from early on, or was it like as kind of different possibilities of being, you know, like non-binary or agender kind of opened up that you were like, actually, this is more fitting?
Yeah, I think I've always felt outside. I've always felt like I don't fit. And I think, you know, like when you're a young child, like sort of like primary school age, gender isn't really a thing that stops you from doing anything. And the camps aren't really as segregated. And, you know, like kids are just allowed to be and play. And then, you know, high school happens and that gets completely turned on its head. And everything is very gendered and very binary. And that was particularly difficult for me because, you know, I didn't feel like I was a girl and I didn't feel like I was a boy. But, you know, people were saying that I was a tomboy because I wanted to do like boy kind of things. But I didn't see me partaking in those kind of activities as gendered, you know. But I think when it comes to sex and sexuality, one of the sort of earliest memories I have is watching. Do you know the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yes, we had it on VHS as a kid.
Yeah, well, so we were poor. We taped it off the telly and then watched it over and over again with the adverts in it. And so I had watched it and obviously instantly fell in love with Jessica Rabbit and then ran into the kitchen to tell my mum that I'd fallen in love with Jessica Rabbit and was just met with a, what does that mean? And the tone alone was just enough to make me know that what I just said was not okay.
Aww.
And so I remember like stumbling for a reply and just being like, I want to be her friend. I just want to be her friend. And my mom was like, good, because you know, like girls can't be in love with girls. And my little like 8-year-old brain just thinking, I don't understand any of this. Like, it just doesn't make sense. But feeling then that what I just experienced and what I just felt and what I just put out into the world was not okay.
Yeah, a very clear message very early.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, something to discuss in therapy years later.
For sure. And I wonder kind of how it unfolded from there. Like, you know, kind of feeling like a tomboy, like, was that, like, I think about this kind of idea of like a queer experience being something that kind of deviates from the quote unquote norm. But like, was that, were you trying to fit in or were you just like, no, thank you? Like, how did you kind of relate to what was going on around you or what you were feeling?
Yeah, I think, again, like, sort of before high school, I never really had to think about gender or how I was acting or putting myself out into the world. And it was just accepted because at that point, you know, kids are kids and you're allowed to, you know, just be. But then high school came and with it came all of these like conflicted feelings of like, you know, I don't fit in and where do I go? And, you know, what does this mean for me? And I think that, you know, for a lot of people and definitely for myself, I tried my best to conform. But there were some things that I absolutely wouldn't budge on. So, you know, like, especially things like the way that I presented myself and my clothing was very not feminine, I will call it, or not stereotypically feminine. And, you know, I wanted to play football. I wanted to play rugby. But also I went to, like, Catholic school. So there was a lot of shame instilled, you know, into kids for everything. And, like, when I was at school, the way that we had to dress was very policed, you know. So even when you were sort of performing as what you were supposed to be, there were parameters within that that you had to sort of stick within. And so, yeah, the entire of high school was just like an experience that made me try to conform, filled me with shame, you know, caused me to have a lot of like internalized queer phobia, you know. So now, like, now I know I have ADHD, and so you know, with neurodivergence comes this sort of way of looking at the world and going, well, you know, according to whom? And so social constructs have never been a thing that's really sat well with me as it is. But yeah,
no kidding. That's awesome.
Yeah, because you know like when you hear people say, oh, like, that's the way it is, and you go, but who made it that way? Who made it that way? It doesn't make any sense. Like, if we created it, we can destroy it. If we created it, it's not real. You know, we can make something else. Like, this is the way that I view the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it seems to have served you really well, although I'm sure that there were moments that it made your life really difficult and uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like, I think, you know, especially in my sort of like late teens, early 20s, when I was really trying hard to conform, but sort of leading almost a double life and like on the surface looking very, you know, cis normative. And then, you know, in my other life, you know, hanging out in sex clubs and having all kinds of weird drug fueled sort of adventures, and really playing with gender and sexuality. Yeah.
I mean, but that sounds like, again, like it might have forced a split. And I think that it's funny, I just had therapy before this and we were talking about that with my therapist, this idea of mm-hmm. like, often I think addiction kind of creates two or more halves, because it becomes like necessary to like divide yourself from your needs or your desires, because they're not kind of they will not function within addiction, and then it's really difficult to like reintegrate, or at least I found it to be.
Yeah, and I think at the time as well, addiction was very much a way of dissociating with the shame, and it absolutely enabled me to, you know, partake in some of the, definitely some of the sexual activities I was, you know, taking part in without having that sort of shame that comes from doing things sober when you haven't sorted your shit out, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do wonder like how drugs and alcohol entered the picture, like what at one point in your kind of your journey as a young person did that start, and like how did it kind of unfold?
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, my earliest experiences of drugs and alcohol started in high school. You know, a bunch of us used to club our sort of lunch money together. We'd buy a bottle of Lambrini and some cigarettes and, you know, go bunk off school for the afternoon. And so it was just sort of like casual drinking, but, you know, that drinking to get drunk that you do when you're a sort of teenager. And so very quickly I learned that there is a way to escape from how I'm feeling and numb myself to what I'm experiencing. And that was, you know, I think coming across that at such an early age was definitely very, very, it led to my addictions. I think the earlier you have that experience of being able to numb with drugs and alcohol, the more likely you are to end up as an addicted adult. And so
for sure. Getting imprinted like a little baby duck.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it becomes a part of you very instantly. And so, yeah, I think I was probably 18, 19 when I started to really, you know that I had a problem, but just call it a good time. You know, oh, this is recreational. All my friends are doing it. But then, you know, not recognizing that all my friends were also getting up and going to work on a Monday and not doing, you know, a bag before they go. And I was. And so, yeah, like drugs were, for me, like a lifeline and a coping mechanism that enabled me to exist, because I was desperately unhappy. I was desperately, you know, trying to repress myself and sort of shield myself from my own thoughts about me and also from the world's opinion of, you know, who I really was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for a lot of us, if not most of us, the like addiction is a form of survival. Until it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's we do the best we can with the knowledge and the tools that we've got. And at that point in my life, or for the best part of a decade, the only tools that I had were drugs and alcohol. And the reason that I didn't have any other tools is because I was too busy getting off my nut.
You know? Yes, like, or recovering from partying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it is a productivity killer for sure.
Definitely.
And I also wonder kind of like when you got diagnosed with ADHD, because I know that like especially stimulants can be a really, you know, self-medication technique.
Yeah, so actually it was through the gender clinic, the first time I saw a private GP to access hormones. We were going through the assessment and he just went, how long have you had ADHD? And I was like, oh, wait, what? And he was like, oh, right, you don't know. Okay.
Perfect response.
Yeah, exactly. And then I remember, you know, like going out and telling some of my friends, I was like, can you believe I have ADHD? And then my friend's going, well, yeah, of course you do. Like, how do you not know?
You didn't
this?
Know that?
Yeah. And they were like, well, why do you think we get on so well? Like, we have it. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So this is like a whole new discovery for me. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. it was one of those moments where you sort of go, oh, okay. Right. Yeah. Oh, like my entire life and everything I've ever done now makes sense. All these habits that I thought were quirky personality are that. So yeah. Yeah. There's been a lot of learning.
Was it like masking, or was it like, this is the strategies I use to function?
Well, yeah, exactly. And so I think that, you know, there's a lot of people that will say, when you go for an assessment and they ask you things like, do you ever feel overwhelmed by noise? Do you have issues with that? And you go, oh no, because I take my earplugs everywhere. And they're like, yeah, that's exactly, that's exactly the thing. You know, you found a way to cope, but you are essentially like, that's what you, yeah. So there's a lot of recognizing that a lot of the sort of things I have in place are coping mechanisms to deal with things like executive dysfunction and, you know, complete sensory overwhelm and rejection sensitive dysphoria. You know, like I have all of these sort of tools in place that I've built, like unknowingly, just thinking that everybody's doing that, but apparently not.
I mean, I'm really curious about the last one. What is rejection sensitive dysphoria?
Oh, it's the worst part of ADHD. It's like, so I will send an email on a Monday morning, and if I don't have a reply to that email by Monday
also
afternoon...
Also Monday morning.
Yeah. I was going to say Monday afternoon, but you're right. Like, instantly, just an hour, I'm like, I'm calling Kat, and I'm going, babe, I think this person hates me. Can you reread my email? Is there something wrong? Have I done something wrong? What's wrong with me? Why aren't they replying? And it's like, so rejection-sensitive dysphoria is that you interpret all of these, you know, nonsensical things into, there's something wrong with me, this person hates me. And like, my wife will tell you that my catchphrase is, are you mad at me?
And that sounds really familiar. I mean, it's nice that they named it.
Yeah, right?
Wow, that's really, I'm like, that's fascinating. amazing. So how did you kind of like, how did you eventually get sober? Like what, you know, where did the gender stuff and the alcoholism and like the neurodivergence kind of converge? Was it a perfect storm, or was it kind of things that you were able to deal with separately in different kind of time frames? Like what was the path to recovery like for you?
So I was so addicted and so consumed in the lifestyle of, you know, waking up and getting high because I needed to take drugs to function. I didn't see any of the other stuff. I just saw that I'm drowning in this and I need to do something. And if I don't get so sobriety for me, by the time I got sober, wasn't a choice. It was an absolute necessity. Like I would be dead if I didn't get sober. And so what had happened was I tried to get sober a couple of times. And I used to do this really like I'm going to call it a stupid thing because it was a stupid thing, where I'd go, oh, I'm just going to do like a 28-day detox just to make sure I can. And I'd do the 28 days without anything. And it would be really tough and really hard. And I'd be in a horrible mood. I was a terrible person to be around. And then on day 29, I'd just go straight back into the same habits all over again. And I'd be looking at everyone around me going, see, I'm not an addict. I can do that. I can do 28 days without it.
I just did 28 days. And they were like, you were such a pleasure to be around during that time.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Like, go back on drugs. We want to, yeah, you're a terrible person. But so I'd done that a few times and then realized that actually nothing changes. And I'm falling straight back into the same thing. And I'm lying to myself. And so in 2019, I was
just
like,
to slow you down a little bit. Like, what was that kind of revelation like? Like, how did you?
Because I think uncomfortable. It was really uncomfortable. Because I think the first step for anyone in recovery is, you know, that sort of light bulb moment where you go, oh shit, I'm doing this to myself, and I'm lying to myself, and like only I can save me at this point.
Yeah.
And that's quite terrifying.
Absolutely.
Because I think, you know, part of addiction is that we, or the entire journey of addiction is that we sort of slowly chip away at our trust in ourselves, because we get to a point where we just can't trust ourselves, you know. We'll go, oh, no, I'm not going to get a bag tonight. But we do, you know. So we're constantly letting ourselves down and learning that we can't rely on ourselves. We can't trust ourselves. So, yeah, that was... The sort of revelation that I was doing this to myself, and that meant that I had control and it was up to me to, you know, sort my shit out, was terrifying.
For sure. I mean, because I do think that there can be this kind of like Outer Boroughs thing. It's like the snake eating its tail when it's like, yep, no one's coming to save me. I can't save me. I'm doing this to myself, but I have to get myself out of this mess. And also that like the call is coming from inside the house. Like,
yep.
That yeah. I'm the one who's like, I'm not going to use, and that I'm the one who's calling the guy. Like, yeah. It's such a, like, I mean, yeah. You know, we're going to be discussing consent together in a couple of weeks.
That's right.
And that whole idea of like self-consent is so just mutilated by active addiction.
Do you know, it's wild, because I, like, so one of my best friends, Tanya, I would message her when I've been like absolutely like at my lowest, like after like a massive bender, just going, oh, you know, I feel awful, I'm so depressed, like I can't carry on like this. And she would message me back and she would put, who's letting you do the drugs? And for the longest time, I would reply with things like, oh, I was with this person, but you know, it's not them, they're not pushing it on me. And it never ever occurred to me that the answer to that question was me. And there was, and I, let I me remember, do the drugs. Yeah. And so like, I've been on this like massive bender and I got this, this was like 2019, and I text Tanya and I was like, oh, you know, like life is terrible and I've done this again. And she replied with the same message. And who's letting you do that? And this, and it finally, and I was like, oh my God, it's me. It's me. I'm letting me do that. Like, I, like, holy shit, it's me. And I remember messaging her and just being like, it's me. Oh my God, it's me. And she was like, fuck for that. Like, finally, you've got it. And like, amazing. I don't know how she had the patience, like, over the years to allow me to make my own mistakes and not just point the shit out to me. But I'm so grateful that she allowed me to come to that conclusion myself. Yeah. So that was like, well, that was one of the catalysts for me going, right, no, this is the time. I'm going to sort my shit out. And so at the end of 2019, I gave up drugs for the last time. I'd given up alcohol when I was 29, and that was just through absolute necessity again. But I gave up alcohol knowing that we'd be moving back to the UK and I'd be able to do drugs more. So
I see. Yeah. Okay, because in Thailand, is there like an alcohol issue?
And so, I mean, in Thailand, I had an alcohol issue, definitely. I mean, it's cheap, it's available, there's not a lot more, much more to do than, you know, especially in rainy season, if, like, you can't go to the beach, so you go to the bar, you know? So, yeah, I was excessive with my alcohol, and I drank every day, and I've been doing these sort of detoxes, and I got to a point where I was just like, nah, I have to stop this. And for the last 6 months we were in Thailand, I was completely sober, but I was only completely sober because I knew that we were moving back to the UK. And I knew as soon as I got back to the UK, I didn't have to be sober anymore because I could just do drugs. But in my mind, in my addict mind, I was going, oh, it's alcohol that I have a problem with. I don't have a problem with drugs. So I've given up alcohol now. So I'm not an addict anymore. I can just go do drugs, you know, and I'll just do them on the weekends when my friends have a drink and that'll be fine. And so, and literally we got off the plane at Heathrow, we drove to my friend's house. And as soon as I walked through the door, I was like, do you know anywhere I can? And he was like, yeah. And straight away, I was back to everyday use. Yeah.
Amazing. And I'm curious, and you don't have to go into this too much if you don't want to, but like, I wonder what happened kind of in your relationship. Is that like turbulent period kicked off?
I think, you know, there've been turbulent periods throughout our entire relationship, but I'm very, very privileged and lucky to have a partner that understands addiction and that is compassionate and patient and helpful. And when I finally did kick drugs and go sober completely, which was in 2020, after a particularly bad relapse. So yeah, so 2019, end of 2019, I gave up everything. I was like, right, that's it, I'm done. And I managed 3 months, and then we went into lockdown. And you know, there's nothing worse for an addict to be than bored.
True.
and in boredom, you like, you know, I had more time to get high, and so I fell off the wagon and straight into, you know, chronic addiction. And by the August, I was so far gone. I didn't even know my own name. Like, I was not functioning. I was just throwing powder up my nose, like at a rate of knots. It was like really terrifying behavior. And so I had a massive overdose at home, and Kat was there. And I remember coming around on the bathroom floor with Kat just looking absolutely fucking terrified, like slapping my face, throwing water at me. And I looked at her and I just thought, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep doing this to her. I can't keep doing this to myself. And then I passed out. The next morning I woke up and, you know, full of apologies as always. And I I said to her, look, I need help. I can't do this by myself. I really, really need some help. And so she just said, whatever you need, we'll do it.
Amazing.
And the next 2 weeks were probably the most horrific 2 weeks of my life, because withdrawal is just disgusting. And it was really, really tough, but she was there every single step of the way, every panic attack, every, you know, like she literally just nursed me through withdrawal, and took care of me. And together, you know, we looked for resources and ways for me to cope. We looked into therapy. I went to a few meetings. Meetings were not for me, it turns out, in the end. But, you know, I feel that they're a great resource for, you know, for people that they do work for. And slowly I got better. But it was rough. The first year of recovery is so hard.
Yeah.
Like, the sitting with yourself was just painful.
Excruciating, yeah. I mean, especially painful. If there's not a lot of experience doing that in the past, and like, you know that you can't, like, the door has to close behind you, and there's no kind of option of that being something that you can turn to again.
Yeah.
So then it's like, okay, so now what? You mean I actually have to, like, feel this, all of this, all the time, forever?
And that's exactly. I've got to feel this, you know, all the time, forever. But because I've been, you know, addicted for so long, you know, we're talking the best part of a decade. Yeah, if not a little longer. You know, to go from having this thing that I could have every day that made me completely numb to, you know, my thoughts, feelings, emotions, and the world. And my drug of choice is a dissociative drug, so I was very disconnected from my body a lot of the time as well. So coming back into that was just like, what the fuck is this?
You know? Totally.
And you know, on top of that, I didn't have any other coping skills. You know, I didn't know anything about mindfulness. So, you know, I didn't have any sort of like soothing sort of skills. I didn't know what to do to make myself feel good. All I knew is that I was feeling all of the feelings all at once, because the thing is, when you take the coping mechanism away, when you stop the numbing, you know, it's still there and you have to deal with it all.
A volume of like 11 out of 10, like,
yeah, because you absolutely. Have
no, you, yeah, as you said, like no buffer and no other strategies. Yeah. So yeah, I'm curious, like, how did you get into the other strategies? Like, what did that kind of reveal itself? Like, you mentioned therapy, you mentioned mindfulness, like, what are the things that, especially early in your recovery, that you kind of like grasped onto that like helped you through that really difficult period?
Therapy. Therapy was like incredible. I had EMDR, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Like, it literally changed my life. And the stabilization period of EMDR was so, so helpful in learning how to, like, learning what my window of tolerance was, and knowing what I could and couldn't cope with, and how to process feelings in a safe way, was like absolutely, you know, like,
crucial.
Absolutely crucial. Yeah, absolutely. And as well as that, I started to, I feel like this is such a common thing in addicts or people in recovery, is that I started to be, and I'd already started to sort of, I wouldn't want to say dabble in Buddhism, but be curious about Buddhist practices when we were in Thailand, because it's a Buddhist country and it's all around you. And so you sort of, you know, you're immersed within it anyway. And I found Thailand to be a much more gentle place than the UK. And so I'd had the time to realize that that was something that was missing from my life. And so I started to look into Buddhist sort of teachings, and especially sort of like mindfulness and meditation. And I started to practice meditation quite regularly. And in the beginning, I was like, this is rubbish. My mind isn't quiet. I can't make it be quiet. And then, you know, you learn that that's not the aim. Your mind's never going to be quiet. That's not what it's about. And also, like, I cannot sell this enough. Coloring in, dude, like coloring in.
What, you mean like coloring books?
Yeah, like coloring books. So cool. Like, I'd like anything that you can just concentrate on that is like simple enough for you to be able to do, but, you know, like the challenge of like, I don't know, staying in between the lines and just focusing on one thing was just really, really helpful. And so I have so many coloring books.
No, but I'm sure also for like the neurodivergence too, it's like, to be able to have yeah, focal point and to train the brain to be able to like accept a flow state.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a fine line between flow and hyperfixation as well. So you have to be a little careful there. Otherwise, you know, you've done like 10 hours of coloring, you haven't eaten, you haven't been to the toilet, you haven't had a glass of water. But...
Facts. I mean, that's amazing though, because it's like, I think for me, when I first came into recovery, I was diagnosed hypomanic. And so a lot of the stuff was just like, I'm on cloud nine, this is amazing. Like really, really rapid cycling. And this idea of like learning what's the difference between like embodied joy and like going into hypomania and kind of like these experiences that without recovery would be impossible to kind of discern because you'd never be in your fucking body anyway.
Right.
It's like such a, you know, I really did not appreciate many or any of the feelings at first, but now it's such a like rich journey to be on, to be able to kind of, yeah, have like a really colorful life in terms of like emotional and embodied states. Like,
yeah, who knew? And to be not overwhelmed by it as well.
Absolutely. Yes, totally. To be able to kind of actually stay with it and be present and not kind of like get kind of, yeah, swept under.
Absolutely.
Sorry, you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say, well, I think that one of the other things that really helped me in the early days of sobriety, especially after experiencing the EMDR, was that my hyperfixation then became learning about trauma. And I read everything I possibly could. And I was particularly interested in, like, you know, the somatic therapies and ways of processing trauma. And so I got really into like Peter Levine and Bessel van der Kolk. And I just sort of like self-studied and eventually was like, okay, I want to go learn this like for real. I'm going to go back to school, which was a really terrifying process. Like because I was in this space of like, you know, healing from addiction, dealing with, you know, all of the things that come up, still feeling like, you know, that sense of I'm not good enough that I think a lot of addicts have, like sort of like woven intrinsically within them.
Absolutely.
And then going back to school for me meant going back to like very early school. Like I don't know, A levels. I left school with like 4 GCSEs. I didn't do well. I was addicted. And so I had to go back to college for a year and get like the qualifications to go to university and then, you know, and then apply for university. And all of that was like these big, daunting, out of my comfort zone sort of steps. But I was so obsessed with, you know, gaining the knowledge to know how to heal.
Yeah.
That's what sort of fueled me through the fear.
That's actually really, really inspiring. Like I dropped out of university to be a drug addict and then to go to rehab. And so I still like, if I want to do any kind of graduate level, anything, I'll have to go back to university, and it scares the shit out of me. So it's really exciting to know that you've kind of had that journey and that you've gotten to where you are. That's really powerful. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks. Thank you. That's really kind of you to say.
And I'm curious as to like, you know, we talked a little bit about before about like getting gender affirming care and how did that like, and also being diagnosed ADHD. I'm curious as to kind of how that intersected with your recovery journey.
So I'd gone back to school and I was in my first year of uni, and all of the thoughts that I have on these sort of societal practices, I guess you call them, throughout the entire of my life, I went to this one lecture, and the module I was taking was called Contemporary Social Inequalities. And there was a lecture where we learned about social construction, and they shared some sort of quotes from Judith Butler.
Awesome.
And literally, like, I came home from this lecture and was just like, well, fuck.
Just ripped your brain now, right open.
Yeah, it was just like, oh shit, now I have words for who and what I am. And you know, like the like it's like the recovery onion. Like you think you've healed, like you heal a part of you and you're like, yay, I did it, and then there's another fucking layer.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh shit, now I have to deal with this. And so I'd done the trauma layer. I had done the adverse childhood experiences to addiction route sort of understanding. And that layer was gone. And then all of a sudden there was just this fucking gender layer. And I was like, fuck's sake, like, for real? Yeah, like, you know, like this is, and it was like, it's such a weird thing to experience, because on the one hand I was like, well, thank fuck. Like now I understand myself because I have the language. And that was what was always missing was the language. I always knew who and what I was and what my experiences were, but I didn't have the words to be able to tell people what that meant to me, or, you know, explain to people what my experience was. And so I went down a sort of gender rabbit hole, you know, sort of academically, and started to read everything there was on gender, and like kept all of this sort of like to myself for a while. Well, my wife is incredibly intuitive, and she said, we were sat down eating dinner one night, and she just said, "Oh, you mentioned something again today about trans or non-binary or something gender related. I just wanted to ask you, like, is the reason that you keep talking about it, are there any thoughts that you're having about yourself?" And I got really defensive, and I was like, "No, why would you say that?" And she was like, I was just asking. And I was like, "No." And I think my defensiveness sort of gave it away that actually inside I was terrified. Yeah. And so, like, you know, I before knowing that I was trans, like from the age of 17, like I was like brought up by trans women after, you know, at that point in my life. And so I'm no stranger to, you know, trans communities. It's just that the trans people that I knew were binary trans.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd still never come across, you know, what I was or where I fit in. I just knew that I felt more comfortable in those spaces. And so the next thing was, I'd just woken up, Kat was on the end of the bed reading something on her laptop. And I was like, "Oh, what are you doing, babe?" And she went, "Oh, I'm just reading an article in Them magazine about non-binary." And I just burst into tears, and I just went, "I think I'm a bit that." And Kat just went, "Oh, honey, I know." So it was like another one of those moments, like with the ADHD, like, yeah, everybody knew but me. Or, yeah, I don't know, maybe everybody knew, but they didn't have the language and it was an unspoken thing. But it was such a relief to actually have it like out, and I couldn't have wished for a better reaction, you know, because I think, you know, for all sort of trans people or like sort of sexuality diverse people, like there's always that, if I tell these people that I love, will I be rejected? And yeah, even definitely. even if you've got the most solid relationships, which I do, like there's still this little voice in your head, because of the way that, you know, certain parts of society are, and because of the shit you read in newspapers, like even though you kind of know you're going to be accepted, there's still that little bit that's terrified, you know.
I'm sure. I mean, and I think also this idea, like, it's such a vulnerable thing, because on one hand, like, one's gender is kind of one's own business, you know, like, yeah, no one can, like, that's your experience of being in the world that nobody should be able to, like, object to, you know, it's like, it's facts. Yeah. But at the same time, if you are in a serious, committed romantic relationship, it is, like, a relational thing too, because it affects how the other person identifies, or it affects, absolutely, their experience of you. And so to kind of be met with so much like gentleness is so, it's such a heartwarming story. It's like, "Oh, yeah, honey, I know." It's like the sweetest, yeah, best possible reaction.
It honestly, like, she's the best. She's absolutely incredible. And yeah, you're right. You know, like, it's when you're, you know, when you're attached to somebody in the way that Kat and I are attached, it means that, you know, for her identity also changed. And I think, you know, that for me was a source of anxiety, thinking that, you know, like, well, you know, she's always been gay. What now? Because I want to be seen for me and who I am, and to be genderless. And I need for her to see that. And mm-hmm. Because I don't want her to continue to see this version of me that I have portrayed previously, now that I'm being authentic. And we talked about it, and I was like, "Well, what does this, you know, what does this mean for you?" And Kat just went, I guess I'm queer. And I guess I've always, you know, been attracted to non-binary beings. It's just that, again, I never had the language for that."
That's really powerful. And I mean, yeah, I wonder if, like, what kind of changed in your life after that? Like, how did you kind of seek affirmation? Because I also think, like, especially post-pandemic, we've been having a lot of, like, non-binary and gender fluid or agender guests on the show. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a big intersection between the, like, necessity of living authentically in sobriety. Because it's, like, I think if one doesn't get, like, part of the, you know, the first step in the 12-step program is, like, honesty. you know, and this idea of like, if you can't live authentically, then it's going to be really fucking hard to stay sober. And absolutely. So, especially post-pandemic, we see a lot of kind of, you know, queer magic kind of as the result of people having the time to go away and kind of not be seen during a transformation. And to be able to, you know, like have an easy step of like maybe putting new pronouns in an Instagram bio or like on a Zoom and like slowly over time kind of revealing oneself as opposed to necessarily like having to go into the world and make a big announcement.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, it's a transition, isn't it? So it's not like a snappy fingers. Oh, now I've realized and everything falls into place. It's like, it's a process. It's a becoming. And so like for me after that moment, it was sort of, you know, sitting with myself and figuring out what I wanted from myself and what I wanted from the world and how I wanted to be addressed and interacted with and how I could live authentically. And in order to take the steps to become, you know, to feel safe enough to live authentically, you have to take, you know, gentle baby steps because this is new. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing was my pronouns, and introducing myself to all my sort of friends and family and doing the, you know, the 15,000th coming out that I've had to do in my life.
At least they're used to it by now.
Right?
Like, actually, newsflash. Like,
yeah, it's so wild that we always think of coming out as like this one event, but it's fucking every day, dude. Like, you know, every time when you sit in a business meeting, you have to introduce yourself and with your pronouns and you're the trans one in the room. It's like, yeah, it's a constant thing coming out. But the initial sort of coming out to sort of friends and family, weirdly, my brother would just knew I was non-binary before I had the language for it and would just be like, oi, non-binary Sam. And I'd be like, fuck off, you dickhead. So when I told him, he just went, I've been telling you for years. So
you're like,
so yeah, again, someone else who knew before I did, which is fun.
But,
yeah, exactly. So yeah, and I had a really, you know, warm reception. And like, you know, there were some people, sort of parents, like, although they took it, you know, I wouldn't say they took it well. It's not like devastating news and they've, you know, had to, you know, find ways to cope. They've been a very accepting, but you know, there's not the knowledge that perhaps, you know, people of a different generation have. And so there's been some learning and some explaining and some, you know, revisiting and some, you know, boundary setting and some boundary reinforcing. And some of it's been work, but we've gotten to a place where, you know, I feel comfortable, respected and loved. And that's fucking brilliant, you know?
That's so beautiful. Cause I mean, I think also you know, you talk about like a transformation, a process, like something that can take time. And this idea of like both internally and externally in relationship, this idea of like allowing the things that need to take time to take time.
Yeah.
That's, I think, really helpful because I think the same is also so true for recovery. Like it takes a while for people in our lives to learn how to trust us again. It takes a while for us to learn how to trust ourselves again. And then to kind of like rebuild relationships in, you know, a vision of what we really want to be in is such like a powerful process. And sometimes it doesn't go the way we want.
Yeah.
You know? And I know that like today you're an auricular acupuncturist who is specifically focused in helping people in recovery. And I'm wondering like, what exactly is auricular acupuncture and like, how did you get into it? And yeah, how does it help people in recovery?
So auricular acupuncture is just a fancy way. It's just a fancy way of saying ear acupuncture. And there's a specific protocol within ear acupuncture called the NADA protocol, which is designed specifically to help people with addiction or in recovery. And so I was in my second year of uni and there was like a community engagement module. And as part of that, you have to choose a placement to go out into the community to like an organization and work essentially. And so I'm browsing through this sort of pamphlet of all these opportunities that all look boring as hell. And then all of a sudden this one with Pathways to Health comes up and it's this community acupuncture for people who are struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. And I was like, oh, my people, brilliant, sign me up. Like, I'm going to do that. You know, like that's a comfortable space for me to be in. And I think one of the things that is most important to me staying sober is of being service to other people that are also in recovery. I think, like, if I can turn my addiction into something as a tool for good, then it has meaning and I can make sense of it.
Yeah.
And I haven't wasted a decade of my life because it's led me here. And so I started volunteering in the acupuncture clinics with Pathways to Health, who are just like the best people. And we run clinics all over town and everybody's invited. It's drop-in. So you come along sort of during the session, you have a nice cup of detox tea, and we give you the 5-point protocol. And so it works incredibly well for sort of like the early stages of withdrawal. So when you have the anxiety and the somatic symptoms, and you know, you need a hand with your body actually detoxing the drugs and alcohol from you, it's incredibly powerful. But then for sustaining recovery, it aids things like it improves your sleep, it reduces stress, helps with anxiety and panic. It's an absolute miracle. And I think the first time that I went to Pathways and they gave me a treatment was just like mind blowing. Like the calmness that you walk out of a session with that like just sustains you for the rest of the week was just like incredible. And so acupuncture very quickly became another tool in my recovery. And last year I was very, very lucky that they applied for some funding for me to become a practitioner. Oh. And so, I'm so privileged and grateful to be, you know, a part of the practitioner team with Pathways now. And so we set up a trans and non-binary clinic, where I serve the trans and non-binary community, because we found as well that the NADA protocol works incredibly well for minority stress, because, you know, again, things like panic attacks or anxiety or sleep issues are all things that are symptomatic of minority stress. So it's useful for all sort of communities that are oppressed or who are struggling to access healthcare. And it's almost like an emergency first aid for mental health.
Amazing. And I know that, like, in our email previously, you talked a little bit about the history of acupuncture as like a support of liberation work. Yeah. And I wondered if you could speak to some of the roots of your craft.
Oh, absolutely. So it was brought over to the US in the 70s, and there were two black doctors, Dr. Talbot Smith and Dr. Mutulu Shakur. Talbot was over in LA, and then Mutulu Shakur was over in NYC. And they had sort of read about the barefoot doctors of China and learned of this, you know, this protocol, NADA protocol, acupuncture that was, you know, having these great results for people with addiction. And they were living in communities that were, they were both members of the Black Panther Party, and they were living in communities that had just been decimated by opioid and crack cocaine use. And so they learned the protocol, they went out into communities, and they were the first people to start these community acupuncture clinics. So bringing people together all at the same time, so you're healing in community in a circle, all with the same treatment, all at the same time. And, you know, like I said, in the early stages of withdrawal, this was like a lifeline to people that didn't have access to healthcare or any alternative methods of getting them through, you know, the most difficult part of recovery, which is the, you know, the start, with such, you know, such powerful, potent, chemically and psychologically addictive drugs. It was an absolute lifeline in these communities.
That's really, really cool. Oh man, thank you. I had no idea about the kind of Black Panther history of acupuncture, especially for addicts. Like, that's really fascinating. Yeah,
it's really cool, right?
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, you also work as a care navigator for the CLARE Project, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the CLARE Project and like what it does and what you do there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the CLARE Project is a small Sussex-based charity that support trans, non-binary and intersex people. And we do a ton of different things. So we run like peer support drop-ins where you can come and meet other trans, non-binary and intersex people, hang out, drink tea, play games. We have different socials. We do like trips to museums and things like that. On Monday evenings, we run a group called Nourish, or rather my colleague Victoria runs a group called Nourish, and trans people all come together and cook a meal together and sit down around a table and have sort of discussions about, you know, things that are affecting them. And it's sort of almost like a therapeutic space to share. But as well as that, we do training and consultancy for any sort of businesses that might want to be more trans inclusive. And we also advise different healthcare providers across Sussex as well. And essentially, we're at the forefront of fighting for trans liberation. And my role, specifically as a care navigator, is, in short, my role is to make sure that anybody going through medical transition within Sussex is well and able and looked after throughout the journey.
That's so generous. Like, wow. I mean, thank you so much for that work, because I think, you know, having watched a few friends go through top surgery, just the physical challenges of recovering from major surgery are massive, not to mention kind of often feeling like working against the flow of a medical system not supportive of trans people, especially in France. Like, this idea of having kind of a container to offer support, you know, no matter what, is so, like, I'm so happy that exists.
Yeah, me too. I went through top surgery privately, and the recovery was, I think, you know, I read everything about recovery and, you know, what, like, the process of it and what would happen and, you know, what I might feel, but nothing prepares you for how you're going to be afterwards. And so I had said to my work, I'd be like, yeah, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Like, sign me up for some overtime. It's all good. And then literally like 2 days after surgery, when the meds were off, just being like, holy fuck, I've been hit by a bus. How am I ever going to walk and talk again? You know, like, and like going out for daily walks and managing like 50 steps and then being like, I'm tired. Take me home.
I have to go home.
Yeah. The struggle was real. But, you know, I'm very, very privileged to have been able to have the surgery. And, like, it has, like, just made my life so much better.
That's awesome. It's so good to hear. And it's so good to hear, again, that, like, there's a place that people can offer support and be given what they need. Especially because I think, you know, it does take a village. Like, you need community in moments like that, especially recovering from kind of, like, hardcore physical stuff.
And this is the thing, is that like, and this I think is the link between, you know, the work that I do with the trans community and the work that I do in recovery, is that we heal in community. You know, everything is better in community. Like, we're better when we're together. It's so important and it's so powerful. And yeah, one of the parts of my role is that to help people that haven't found their community yet build relationships and bring them into the fold.
That's so awesome. I mean, I think like it sounds like a lot of what you do runs very parallel to kind of my experience with 12 steps, which I know is like, it's not necessarily your thing, but I think, you know, in certain aspects can be really like create similar things to what you've built for yourself, which I think is really like, it's my favorite thing to be like, oh, the addicts love each other. all we want to do, like, addicts are just obsessed with helping other addicts.
You're like, right, if we though, can find somebody. Right. Like, we do, we have to love each other. Like, nothing. It's
like, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, let me, like, I can show you the world, you know?
Oh, totally. And also this idea of like, kind of needing, having like somewhat remedial like friendship making skills, because like prior your only hobbies were drugs and alcohol, to be able to be like, and now we can make right. friends, like, it's so yeah. I don't know, it just like, it warms my heart.
Bringing someone into the community is like showing them your favorite rock, you know, being like, look at this, you can have them too.
You're like, I'll very even nice. Give it to you. It's so cool. Very nice.
Yeah. I think it's really powerful in, you know, believing in something so much that you want to share it, you know, and being so, so passionate about what we have that you just want to share it with everybody that you can, you know, it's special.
Absolutely. And I think also there is this kind of underdog quality, or, you know, especially in another kind of intersection point between the trans community and recovering addicts, is this idea of people who have like, and oftentimes been like cast out by other parts of society, to find a group that is like ferociously loving and also understands and identifies with the struggle. It's like, it is such a beautiful process to be part of. And it sounds like you've kind of created, you've built your life in so many ways in that light, you know, which is really cool.
Yeah. I think, you know, the general sort of ethos is the more you oppress us, the more we'll love each other.
Oh, yeah. I, you know, it's funny. I like, I haven't heard it put in those words before, but I definitely think it's true in many kind of prismatic factions. And I do wonder kind of how your recovery has affected your own life and your relationships. Like, what does that look like today?
So recovery allowed me to be me and live authentically. And because I can be myself 110%, like no bullshit, I can be vulnerable. And those two things combined, vulnerability and authenticity, mean that my relationships are so much deeper. My connections are so much more meaningful. And I can be so much more loving, and I can receive so much more love. And it's, I think the one thing that I wasn't prepared for in recovery was the fucking joy of it, man. Like, because again, I don't think we realize as addicts that, like, when we numb ourselves, you can't, you know, like, you can't selectively numb your emotions. So whilst, you know, we took the edge off the pain and the sad and all of that kind of shit, we don't get to feel the joy. We don't get to feel the good stuff. And so, like, within my relationships, especially, like, these moments of clarity, like, pure fucking clarity and joy and love are just, like, that's a high all of its own, you know? You can't buy that shit.
Absolutely. And also, it's kind of unknowable in any time, like, but the present and in recovery. Like, there can be a kind of heightened manufactured element on chemicals, but there's this very kind of deep and rich and nourishing quality in recovery that, especially, I think, because often the relationships are kind of built out of a shared adversity, that is, like, so powerful and so fun. You know, you could, like, laugh at the darkness together. Yeah. It's, like, incredible.
Oh, and I'm wondering, another thing that recovery gives you is a sick sense of humor.
Yeah, I mean, because, again, like, if you're not going to laugh at it, then, like, what are we doing here? It's like,
right?
It's too dark. And I'm wondering where you're growing today. Like, what part of your life are you kind of leaning into or expanding, or what, like, fears are you walking through?
So when you say the word growing, I think the area of my life, or of me right now, where that is most at the forefront, is that I'm growing into my body. Like, I'm growing into the body that I was meant to have, you know, through my transition. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been taking low dose hormones, like testosterone, for the past year now, and the journey of that, you know, is another journey of becoming, and waking up every day and seeing all these, like, new hairs sprouting, or, like, parts of my body sort of changing and getting more angular, and that whole process, I cannot tell you how fucking beautiful it is to just slowly be coming into, like, the version of me that's always existed in my head. Like, to see that becoming reality, like, that journey of growing is just, it's really something special.
That's really beautiful. You look so excited when you talk about it, and it's like,
we
love gender euphoria on Sober Sex. Or agender euphoria, I guess. Awesome. That's such a, like, a rad note to end on. So we're gonna, to, like, kind of leave on a sparkly note, we're gonna transcend into the lightning round. So don't think too hard. Don't
right.
It's got it. Seriously, no big deal. Okay, what is your favorite sandwich?
My favorite sandwich, Marmite. Anything with Marmite on it, but yeah, just standard cheap white bread with Marmite and cheddar cheese.
Ooh, that's like kind
of, I grew beast. Up on that. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. What's your favorite way to kind of pump yourself up and, like, kind of get into like a higher energy state if you're feeling low?
So if I need energy, I tend to walk into nature and just restore myself. But if I need, like, an instant, right, I gotta go, I need to pump myself up for something, it's definitely through music. and it's normally through something cheesy and 80s-ish.
What's on the playlist these days?
Oh, it's Aztec Camera, Somewhere in My Heart. Flock of Seagulls, Iran.
Amazing.
Yeah, like just all like 80s nonsense.
Perfect. I've been recently vibing to a very beautiful version. There's like an unplugged version of A-ha's Take Me On that is so beautiful. It makes me really emotional, but then we listened, my partner and I listened to the original electric version also while dancing in the kitchen with the dog, and it's like ecstatic.
They're happy songs, right? Like the upbeat, synthy kind of like new wave stuff.
Perfect.
Yeah, beautiful.
Amazing. What's your favorite way to kind of downregulate if you're feeling anxious, or if you're just kind of like feeling a little too speedy and like how do you kind of settle and ground?
So there's a sort of ritual that comes with making a good herbal tea. So going into the kitchen, put the kettle on. I make my own tea bags because what else do you do when you're in recovery? When you're not playing, when you're not waking up, you need to do more shit. You start making your own tea, you know? So, you know, I'll put a little bit of valerian and some lemon balm and like a good cup of herbal tea, but the ritual of doing it and the sitting down and taking the moment to be like to drink it mindfully, that's kind of perfection.
Excellent. That's actually like a pro tip. Take note, listeners. Finally, what turns you on? And that can be like sexually, or it can be like intellectually, creatively, kind of like what gets you going.
Okay, it's such a long list, but let's stick to consent. Consent turns me on because there is nothing hotter than a genuine, full, embodied, wholehearted, yes, I want to do this with you. Like that shit's sexy.
That's
like,
so that funny. So
I tend to though, right?
Yo, I recently, this is way too much information, but okay. Recently I got on antidepressants and it makes it really difficult to come. So my partner was like, we should watch porn. I'm like, okay, like, well, I don't believe it'll work. And literally just during the kind of like pregame, like consent talk, I was like, this is amazing. It's like, I don't even need to watch porn. I just need to watch. Yeah. I just need to watch people like be like into each other consensually.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Like, maybe I have a consent kink. And he's like, you definitely do. What the fuck? And finally, what do you love?
What do I love? I love, this is, like, it's the cheesiest answer, but my wife.
Yay! We all love your wife.
Yeah, my wife is
awesome. Hi, Kat. Shout out, Kat.
She's the absolute best. She's incredible. I love my wife. I love my life. I love my dog. I love Marmite sandwiches. And I've loved this conversation. Thank you for having me.
No, it's such a pleasure. It's really, really nice to get to know you. One sec, I'm going to stop the recording.
Authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth.